Yes, it's lovely. It's lovely to be in my home centre again, giving a talk again. It's nice, actually. The last one was in the theatre, which I really like, but it's quite a nice intimate feel here. I don't have to project my voice so hard. I didn't, actually. It's got very good acoustics, the theatre, isn't it? Yes, tonight, as Arajai said, this evening it's part of the Dimensions of Awareness series. So today we're coming to awareness of others. Yeah? So on Sunday we celebrated Sangha Day. Yeah? I was down in Kent giving a talk very much like this one, actually. Remarkably like this one. But actually, the actual Sangha Day was, in fact, last night. It's on the full moon, and I don't know if any of you noticed it. It was called a super moon. I think it's was it 68 years or something? 78 years since the moon has been this close to the Earth. Yeah? Akasha Jyoti was just saying, but it looks so small. But I actually saw it at about 5, or, you know, quite early in the evening, and it was actually quite bright and quite big. Hopefully the Sangha jewel will come that close and that bright in our lives. I think it's very appropriate that we're exploring. We've engineered it so that we're exploring awareness of others so close to Sangha Day. Because when we celebrate Sangha Day, yeah, in effect we're celebrating awareness of others. Well, you could say we're even celebrating awareness with others, at its deepest levels. So Bhante Sangharajita, he's put a lot of emphasis on practicing with other people. It was him that suggested that we found a special day to celebrate Sangha on. So we've got the three jewels, and they're jewels because they're precious and significant. They're the most precious and significant aspects of our life together as a spiritual community. Yeah. And the Sangha jewel, well, our life together as a spiritual community, it's one of the most significant things for us if we want to become fully free, fully awakened. Yeah? And that's because without the Sangha jewel, we don't have access to the Buddha. We don't have access to the example of the full freedom and awakening of the Buddha. And we don't have access to his teachings, yeah. That understanding that leads us to that awakening. So it's the Sangha jewel. It's that most precious and significant thing that makes it possible for us to live more fully and freely, yeah. So Bhante saw this, and he also. He also made a special point of drawing out the particular significance of awareness of others. Yeah? I think I'm right in saying that you won't directly find awareness of others highlighted in a way in, say, the Anapanasati Sutta or the Satipatthana Sutta, two key texts for our practice of awareness. Yeah? So But Bhante felt that we're so profoundly affected by others, yeah, that that in a way we needed to focus particularly, well, that awareness of others deserved a focus of its own. And he sort of pulled it out in when he developed his dimensions of awareness. He pulled it out and gave it special attention because others are so critical in our lives. So, firstly, I would like to look at the place of others in our lives. Well, the place of others in general in our lives, yeah? And how practicing awareness in this area can be a real source of joy and freedom, yeah? Then we'll have a look at how practicing within, specifically within the spiritual community, going for refuge to that Sangha jewel, can really enhance this practice and strengthen its impact so that we can really be truly and deeply free, alive, awake. Okay. So firstly, let's look at awareness of others in general. And see how bringing awareness to the effect of other people and to our interactions with them can really become a very effective and enjoyable spiritual practice. It can become a means of drawing us out of our narrow, confining perspective by resonating and making heart connections with others. So, a bit like Ratnadharani, a couple of weeks ago, for those of you who are here, I'm going to have to own up to something here. I don't really think awareness of others is my strongest point. quite apart from starting out my Buddhist life as rather shy and a little bit in a world of my own, really. Well, I was shy. I was in a world of my own. I don't know. We had in those days, I think, I don't know if they're still doing it these days, but certainly when I was doing it, up to the time of our ordination, we had various sort of things that they thought that would really sort of test our mettle in a certain sort of way. Yeah. So one of the things was to go out in the middle of the night, yeah, like the Buddha did, sort of leaving everything behind, going forth into beyond our comfort zone, into a situation that would really sort of test our mettle, sort of challenge, test our resolve. Yeah. For me, I have to say, this was in the context of a big retreat. I think there must have been 30 of us all preparing ourselves for ordination. And we had these sort of group sessions every day. And I have to say that for me, the real fear and challenge was not in going out into the peat bog in the middle of the night. It was sitting there in a room full of people having to expose myself and learning how to sort of interact socially with them. So it just made me laugh when they sent us off. Oh, phew! So anyway, yes. Have you come across those tests where they give you pictures of people, people's faces, yeah, with certain moods and expressions on them, yeah, and you have to say what the person is feeling, yeah. Have you come across those? You know, I think they sort of say that particular categories of people are very good at doing this. So some of the categories are Buddhists and policemen, or, you know, creatives, you know, people who sort of are used to doing this work. I am hopeless at those. I really cannot tell what's going on. So, yeah, I didn't score very highly the last time I did it, and that wasn't that long ago. Anyway, so maybe it's a case of really sort of sharply experiencing the importance of something in your life, and it's not necessary that it comes easily to us. Yeah. So, like it or not, we are very affected by other people. I would say most of the time they're what occupies our energy. Yeah. Whether we're actively engaged with them, or concerned consciously or unconsciously with the effect of a relationship. Yeah. They may not be immediately present to us. We may live on our own. We may not have a lot of ongoing contact with other people. But there are so many ways in which we're affected by other people. They take up our emotional and mental space. This became quite clear to me when I was on long retreat. I didn't see very many people at all for that time. But actually, as my mind became clearer and my heart became lighter, I felt more and more in touch with others. Yeah, there was more space for me to be affected by them. Yeah? So it was interesting that over time it felt like my connections with people actually got stronger and stronger. Maybe that's partly because they weren't there to irritate me. But it was a very tangible effect. So, if you haven't done so before, it might be worth reflecting on how connected our lives actually are. Yeah. So right from the very start, I mean, I'm stating the obvious here, but we're totally dependent on caregivers, yeah? Nappy changers, feeders, those who've earned the money to support us, and other people who've done all of those things for those people in their turn, yeah? So we couldn't even make our entrance into the world without other people. Let alone obtain the nourishment that we need. We couldn't hear and learn. Everything we hear and learn comes from other people. The conditions of our world, the values that we grew up in, the values that we hear about all the time in our adult life. And the infrastructure that all the people have created too. So again, it's not necessarily direct, but all the schools, all the social services, all the governance structures. We even owe our gene identity to other people. Yeah, have you seen? There was a little video going around about who do we think we are, something like that, where they got lots of people in a room and they did their gene mapping. They worked out, they could work out sort of geographically where all their genes came from. So to start with, they were interviewing people and saying things like, well, you know, are there any they're all from lots of different cultures, and you know, they were saying, well, are there any sort of cultures that you find particularly difficult, or are there any reasons why you really enjoy being Turkish or British or whatever it was? And a lot of the people that they interview would say things like, well, yeah, I mean, of course being British is the best thing to be. And, well, I'm not sure, you know, I have to admit, I do struggle a bit with the Germans, or, you know, like the Turkish would struggle with the Kurdish, you know, some pretty obvious tensions in there. It was amazing how much of the time, actually, when they did the gene mapping, like the guy who was so British that was all there could be, I think he was 37% German or something, more German than he was English. You know, so it's like we're such a mix of different cultures and identities, but we can be so strongly who we think we are. So yeah, we even owe our gene identity to other people. And have you noticed how other people tend to engage our energy? Yeah, I certainly notice in my experience how immediately my attention is drawn out by other people. Yeah, to the point where I can lose connection, lose awareness of everything else. Yeah, if there's something sort of vivid in relation to another person, in my experience. Bhante practiced mindfulness exclusively for about 7 years, I think, and he got extremely good at it. You know, even when, like, the act of what I just did, you know, lifting my hand to scratch my nose, yeah, would be done with such, well, with what seemed to me like breathtaking conscious attention, yeah. But he said he found where he found it hardest to practice was when he was having a really good conversation with someone. Yeah, he would just get swept up in the excitement of the exchange. So we're all involved with others so much of the time, and well, in a way, it's great that it brings that energy, that liveness, that sort of creative enlivening. It refreshes our hearts and minds. It brings really enduring and intimate bonds. Yeah, we feel connected. We feel able to experience love. For both giving and receiving it. So other people are a real source of happiness. And they can be a real source of distress. So sometimes in relation to other people, we can also feel isolated. Yeah? We can feel left out. Unable to make meaningful connections. In the case of children, it's hard to give them what they want, yeah, what they need, or be a good enough parent. Yeah? We get irritated. We're irritated or distressed by other people's behaviour, both on a personal and again on an institutional level. Yeah? Sometimes even a cultural level. Speaking of myself, some of my most distressed times have been when I've been in an ongoing conflict with someone. And I suppose the question for me here is, how is it possible that as reasonable people we can think and feel so differently? How can people think and feel so differently to me? Yeah, have such different core values. I think we've got incredibly good examples of that at the moment, haven't we, with President Trump and Brexit going on. So, I mean, you know, there are really different perspectives, very, very strongly alive in our midst. And, you know, we can say, oh, well, it's about fear, or it's about this, but it's actually just about people living very different lives to us and having very different experiences. So So in the words of the sages, I'm not sure which sages these are, but it is said that heaven is other people, and so is hell. Yeah? So we're blown about by the worldly winds, the winds of praise and blame, of pleasure and pain, a gain and loss of fame and infamy. Yeah? And all of these, well, they're very tied up with other people, aren't they? What their views and responses might be, you know, how we are in relation to that, whether we are or aren't going to get what we want or need. And we base our actions on that quite strongly. But it's very unreliable, yeah? That's why they're called the worldly winds. They blow us about. We're blown about by our desire for things, particularly people, to be different to how they are. Yeah? And in that sense, we aren't free. Yeah, can we see that? Yeah, how we're not free because we're blown about by all of this. That's quite key, I think. So if we want to change our behaviour, yeah, to something that's going to cause less suffering and lead to freedom, then I suggest that looking at how we interact with other people is a very good place to start. Yeah? So our practice of ethics is based on relationship with others. Yeah, it doesn't exist in isolation. It's bringing us into harmonious relationship with other people, yeah? Bringing awareness into our relationship with others. Yeah? So when we act out of care and consideration and not out of our own appropriative interests, our world gets bigger, more alive, more fulfilling. We can enjoy the success of others and resonate. If we resonate with their failures, it helps us to feel connected in our common humanity. Yeah. So I haven't really got time to do justice to the whole territory of ethics here, but if we approach our practice of the precepts with a sense of it as a way of really connecting us and bringing us into harmony with others, it's much harder to take the precepts as injunctions, you know, as commandments, as things we really ought to be doing better at. Yeah, we're sort of drawn into that harmony. Yeah. So when we act from a more self-referential basis, there's a tendency to see people as objects. In other words, in relation to ourselves as subjects. And it's all sort of tied in with, and we're affected by, well, it's all tied in with how we're affected by them. Yeah. So this goes very deep. An example. So if I ask you to think of a friend, so if you think about a friend now, okay, and think about why you like that friend. Can you do that for a minute or two? Just think about a friend and why you particularly like that friend. Okay? Okay, so I don't know how far you've got, but the chances are an honest response would include things like: they like me. They respect me. They encourage me when I feel low. They celebrate my achievements. I feel good around them. They bring out the best in me. Simple. Yeah? Similarly, we don't like someone, maybe, because they interfere with my happiness, they hurt me or those I love, they make me feel unsafe, or bad about myself? Do you see the common factor in all of this? Have you noticed the me word? I mean, it's so understandable, isn't it? It's so relatable to you. And yet, there it is. So it is all very well as far as it goes. But the issue, the problem with this, is that we start to depend for our happiness on this assessment. Yeah? Our feelings of safety and comfort and self-worth are all tied up here. Yeah? So it's inherently unstable because we're dependent on external conditions that we can't ultimately control for our comfort. These conditions can and will change. Yeah? This is the worldly winds. We're blown about by them. And also, it doesn't take into account that the fact that we are only part of the picture. Rakhigosha was saying right back at the start when you were doing the introductory talk, people can have thoughts and feelings and whole functioning lives, yeah, completely without reference to me at all. Isn't that peculiar? Isn't that strange? When you stop and think about it, it's just strange. So empathy can really deepen if we're able to see people in their own contexts and not just in relation to us and our worlds. Yeah? So maybe this is why Iris Murdoch apparently said that love is the very difficult realization that other people are real, have feelings, and are separate from us. That's what love is. So, as Ratnagosha mentioned, when we walk along the street, in supermarkets, on the bus, in traffic jams, we're surrounded by other people with lives that function fully without any reference to us at all. And if we feel resourced enough and confident, we can take an interest in them. Yeah? In their own right and not in relation to us. We may have to work a bit harder to do this, to create more space, to listen more, to challenge some of our own assumptions, ask questions about how their world is. Yeah? But this sort of empathy can broaden our worlds and lighten our hearts, even though it can be a real challenge to accept that people don't basically see things the way that we do. Yeah? So not only does it broaden our horizons and bring joy through a feeling of expansiveness and real connection, yeah, but each time we do this, it weakens that fortress of self-reference that's at the root of all our suffering. Yeah? It may seem like a very little thing, just a very little switch, just to take a little bit of a breath and just wonder, well, what's it like to be that person, to be in their world? But actually, if we just keep making those very little switches and steps, it builds into something really quite different. Yeah, so seeing them more fully as people and relating to them, not on that basis, not only brings us into empathetic connection with others, but it starts to shift the foundation of our worldview. Yeah? So I suppose the question then naturally arises, how do we bring this empathetic perspective more into our lives. Yeah? So there's a lot beginning to come out these days, I think, on how to cultivate empathy and compassion. It seems almost that it's the new secular mindfulness. Yeah. In particular, things like empathetic or active listening. Yeah? And I do welcome this trend, actually. As Iris Murdoch says, it's not easy to understand what it's like from somebody else's perspective. So we need all the help we can get to bring awareness more and more fully into our interactions, to develop a caring curiosity and build up an understanding of what the other person's experience is. It needs a real willingness to listen, and the active part is to keep recognising where we're wanting to bring our own perspective in all the time. So it's not that our responses aren't important, but they're only part of the picture. We want to be able to see beyond the way that they're colouring our interpretation of events. Yeah? As Ratna Dharani said a couple of weeks ago, we used to practice communication exercises quite a lot. This would be somewhere where we could set up the conditions where we really could just look at another person. Just look at another person, just take them in fully. And as she said, it was a guaranteed way of emptying the sentence. But actually, when you think about it, how often is it that we get that chance? Yeah? Just to really take another person in without having to sort of, you know, fulfil any of our mutual expectations about what to do. I think when I've done it, I always sort of quake a bit to start with, but I do come out feeling energised and brighter, and yeah, my world has been enriched. So that is, you know, that's one way that we can explore this territory. Another way of using our awareness of others to work on our limiting self-centered tendencies is the practice of moving from I to we. Yeah. So a Tibetan friend of mine once told me that it was really just a passing comment, actually. He was talking about how Tibetans are brought up culturally quite differently to us. And this is before you even start talking on in a spiritual way. This is just a purely cultural thing. So that they're brought up so that when they enter a room, they'd naturally be wondering not, how am I in this situation? Yeah, but how are we? You know, how does the room feel? Yeah, that's just naturally how they'd be thinking when they walked into a room. That's quite astounding, really, isn't it? Amazing. And I wonder how it would be for us to work more in that way from this perspective. So sometimes this happens quite naturally. Singing in choirs, in orchestras, collective rituals can really have that, give us a sense of that. So from that point, touching on that, those sorts of experience, it then becomes a question, well, when is that closing down? When is it not feeling like that? Yeah. When is the perspective narrowing? Yeah. When does it start to narrow? When do we start to get protective and self-concerned in an unhelpful way? And then very compassionately to ourselves, see if we can ease that sense of narrowing down, of closing. Yeah. What does it feel like if we consciously start to use the language of inclusivity a bit more? Yeah. Before we look at some examples, just for the sake of of those of us who are prone to low self-esteem. Yeah, I just want to emphasize that we're talking here of moving from I to we. Yeah, we're not talking of moving from I to them. Okay. So we are very much part of that inclusivity. Yeah, we're very much part of the picture. So we don't need to lie down in the middle of the road and let ourselves be driven all over by other people's needs, often their neurotic needs. It's not about what I call speed bump compassion. Yeah. yeah. It's we're moving from I to we. This is very inclusive. Yeah. So some examples of moving from I to we. What would they be? So instead of thinking in terms of my stress in the traffic jam. Yeah. It's our stress in the traffic jam. We share it with everybody in the traffic jam. Yeah. Her talk, listening to her talk, or in my case, my talk, to exploration of the Dharma, our exploration of the Dharma, our sharing this time in this room together. Helping out at the centre, my local centre, shifting that maybe to our centre, yeah? What we're building. You get the picture. Yeah. So, yes. I was listening to something on the radio today about air pollution, and I could sort of feel like, oh, the air I breathe. And I was thinking, yes, the air we breathe, the air the whole planet breathes. So, yeah, it's once you start to look, you can find it everywhere. Yeah. And that gives a clue to where we're narrowing down, where we're starting to sort of separate off. So anyway, that's a little taste of the vast potential of taking others as directly as practice, as our practice of awareness. But I just want to look a little bit at the practice of what the place of the practice of Sangha is in all of this, and how it can help to support and deepen that process. So when we share experiences as a Sangha, we get the benefit of doing this on the basis of our ethics, yeah? So that we're coming more and more into a meaningful, deep connection in a context where that care and sensitivity not only is it awakened by other people, but it's very mutual. So it's explored and expressed in a context where it will be recognised as a move towards being more alive and responsive to each other as complete individuals. So it's that there's a mutual recognition in there, yeah? And it's that shared awareness of practice in the Sangha. It's very mysterious. It can have a very mysterious but very tangible effect. Yeah, and it really supports that sort of mutual, I tried to call it mutual reflexiveness, but Vassandra wouldn't let me get away with that. I don't know. Anyway, you know what I'm getting at, that sort of that we reflect, you know, it's sort of strengthened through that reflection. Yeah, and it really supports our practice of love and awareness of others. So if it's working effectively, it also emphasizes and enhances that shift in our worldview. It eats away at our limited sense of self. And it can really release us from that prison of our own limited views and perspective. Yeah. So this is why, historically, as a Sangha, we've looked for opportunities to really practice together in this way. Yeah. So you've heard my history, you know, a lot of Right Livelihood projects, communities, But it can be anything, you know, any way that you come together in a study group or in a joint project. But we're not here, we're not just talking about working together for the greater good. Yeah? I said it was mysterious. It is mysterious, very mysterious, but it's not magic. Yeah? It's not as if just by waving a wand and doing good, this will lead to the complete end of suffering. Yeah? We will build up an incredible amount of merit, of punya, of positivity, of positive energy. Yeah? But on its own, it will not lead to the end of suffering. Okay? For that to happen, it has to have that element of reflecting each other back quite consciously in this way. Yeah? Eventually, it has to have that dimension of wisdom. And this is what an effective Sangha can bring. Yeah? A friend of mine who has now retired, Arya Jaya will know who I'm talking about, spent quite a lot of her adult life working in war zones. But just before she retired, she came across the world from Australia to take the opportunity to work in a Buddhist right livelihood business. So her descriptions I found quite striking of her experience working in these war zones. They were quite harrowing, as you might expect, but it wasn't just the suffering of those people that they were trying to help, but the fact that they didn't have the inner tools, the inner resources to work together in such a pressurized situation. Yeah? So an immense amount of sort of really wanting to change the world, real motivation, yeah? But they didn't have those inner tools. So their working relationships were characterized, according to her, by constant arguing and taking the stress out on each other. Yeah? Eventually, after many years of working in these situations, she realized that no amount of altruistic intention alone would be able to overcome such difficulties. Yeah. So, without having that perspective of understanding and the ability to substitute some of those reactive responses for more creative ones. I'd love to ask this question here because I know some of you, like me, have spent quite a long time working in right livelihood practice businesses. So. I'm not sure if I'm quite playing devil's advocate here, but I'm just asking the question, I suppose. So is it enough to even sort of throw ourselves in, put ourselves fully into Buddhist communal practices, yeah? However wholeheartedly, is that enough? That's the question I'm asking. So they really give us opportunities to go beyond ourselves, yeah? If there's enough faith, we can really engage in something that has meaning for us. And we do learn to respond more creatively and harmoniously. But I'd also say it really helps to have a strong culture of awareness and that mutual exploration. Not only of our sort of surface habit patterns, but of those deepest assumptions, yeah, of our assumptions at those deepest levels. It's been my experience that even when I was very engaged in Buddhist communal practices, I sometimes had the feeling that I was sort of coasting, yeah. And I've wondered a lot about that, you know, because I was so engaged, and in a way, you know, I wasn't thinking about myself. I was just, you know, engaging. Most days it certainly wasn't easy a lot of the time, as many of you will tell. we'll know. And most days I really did wake up and think, what can I do to help improve the situation as much as I can today? I really did wake up and think that most days. And I had a ready-made context to practice generosity in. So I really made inroads into some of my less sociable tendencies. I think I genuinely became less grumpy in the mornings. Would you agree?
I didn't know you before.
No, you probably didn't know me in my grumpy face, it's true. And I certainly, you know, I even became a little bit more concerned about creating harmony and, yeah, had a sense of how I could do that. But it was still, it was all basically set in this fundamental premise of what I did or didn't do well, yeah, what I could or couldn't do. So I never really succeeded in making that fundamental shift in perspective from what I could do for the situation today to being part of something that was not really about me in that limited sense at all. So even though I often had to and quite willingly did put my own personal preferences aside, I usually experienced quite a strong element of self-reference while doing that. Do you see this sort of subtle distinction? Because I think that really did give rise to this feeling of limitation. It's quite subtle, but it had a big effect on me. So, and I think, again, I'm just, you know, this is just coming out of I don't know where, but I think maybe in the early days we were helped by having Bunty around more. Because I think it's almost as if he functioned as... do you remember that word that Ratnadarani used? Sati Sampajana, yeah? That sort of mindfulness, lucidity of mind, conscience, attention, comprehension, yeah? All of those things. Bhante was there. He was exemplifying that quality of awareness in everything that he engaged in. And in a way, he held us quite directly in relation to an awareness of the root cause of our suffering and what we were doing to perpetuate that. So I think sort of just by his active presence, he allowed that dimension of insight to be present and alive amongst us. Yeah. And I must say, even sometimes when I go to Adishtana, where he lives, I get a sense of this practicing there. You know, I don't know what it is. Now I'm getting very mysterious. Anyway, I do think that was maybe quite strong and maybe helped us to get the feeling that we could just sort of throw ourselves into things in this way. And I think that there are definitely many around our centres who function in a similar way to this, even though they may not realise it. But in my experience, I wasn't able to do this. I wasn't always able to do this effectively. And I did, as I said, I did feel the limitations of that. I'd get caught up so much in day-to-day concerns. And, it really wasn't... it wasn't as an expression of something bigger, it was just ends in itself. So, yeah, in the absence of Bhante's direct example, that real sort of linchpin of that sort of conscious awareness, if you like, I think it would have helped me to have brought this aspect of awareness in much more consciously, yeah? So, for me, how does that happen? What it means for me is questioning even more basic assumptions, yeah, in the way that I don't normally do. So, okay, so we want to help others and we want to really connect with them. Yeah, we want to learn to take in and care for the other person in their own right and not just in relation to me. Bhante talks about this. He talks about this subtle, non-appropriative appreciation of others, and he says it's fascinating. It's sort of amazing the different levels that he talks about. So to start with, he says it's not about seeing there in a beauty. So he's talking about the practice of love, I think, really, loving awareness. It's not about seeing their inner beauty while blinding ourselves to their weaknesses. Yeah? Okay, so far so good. So nor even about learning to appreciate their weaknesses. Yeah? So I don't have to think their weaknesses aren't weaknesses. Yeah? Or I don't even have to appreciate their weaknesses. That's not what it's about. Or appreciating them in spite of their weaknesses. Yeah? So he says, at this point, we know their frailties in full. Yeah? But this knowing has no effect on our loving regard. Yeah? So we know their frailties in full, but it has no effect. Yeah? He says that with real love, we nurture without cherishing any illusions about them. Yeah? So we're not dependent on what they think of us. Yeah? We're not dependent on those worldly winds. Yeah? Okay, so how do we approach this way of relating? Well, we do need, I think, to unpick some of the assumptions that stop us seeing with eyes of love in this way, with seeing other people clearly in their own right. Yeah. And to do that, we really have to look into what another person is. Yeah. What is another person anyway? We don't often do this, do we? So, for example, you know, we might walk into a room with a couple of other people in it, and one of those people is smiling and meeting our gaze, and one is maybe a bit cut off, avoiding us, maybe looking a little cross. So our initial response might be to be attracted to the one who's smiling at us and engage with them, and resistant to the one who's avoiding us. Straightforward enough. But with a little reflection, we come to understand, and I think, you know, we're all familiar as practicing Buddhists, we come to understand that how they are may have nothing to do with us at all. Yeah, the one who is smiling may have a tendency to smile when they feel awkward, maybe smiling about something completely different, and they may actually be quite annoyed with us for all we know. The one who's avoiding us may be absorbing some very difficult experience, may be excruciatingly shy, or may have had previous bad experience in encountering strangers. So, so we don't know, do we? And we can wait. We can practice this active, engaged listening. We can just sort of create a space for things to unfold before we need to make that response. Well, so far so good, and I think, you know, we're quite sophisticated with this. You know, in our practice, we've learnt really that we can explore and we can revise these sorts of assumptions that we make. And if we do that, that we can greatly reduce the amount of suffering that we and others experience. But how often do we walk into that room with those other people in there? And how often do we ask the question, not how are they feeling about us or how are they feeling in their own right, but what is a person anyway? What is another person? What is another person? Yeah, there's a whole network of assumptions. Yeah, that just still remain very firmly intact. Yeah, and never really get questioned. So obviously, we need these assumptions in place to operate effectively, to communicate, to go about our lives. But the trouble is that they're so ingrained that we don't see that they are that they are assumptions. They're just interpretations of our experience. And very quickly, these interpretations take over our lives as facts. You know, that's it. That's what their life like. Two-dimensional, slap a label on, that's it. Yeah? As Bhante says, we become blind to the starriness of things. Yeah? We become blind, in this case, to the starriness or the complete unknowable wonder of another person. Yeah? Just blind to it. We slap the label on. Hannah. That's it. Finish. I've got about two of you to slap a label on there. So, as Buddhists, we learn that we can relate to ourselves as more fluid, ever-changing, non-fixed, with no real substantial essence. We learn that. And this applies to other people. Every single other person this applies to as well. Yeah? So we suffer. We suffer when we act as if this isn't the case. We suffer when we seek permanence, when there isn't any. And when we try to resist this mysterious creative flow of experience. Yeah? We put labels on things, including ourselves and other people, and then forget how miraculous and ungraspable everything is beneath those labels. We suffer from this, and others do too. This is the root cause of all suffering. And when we catch a glimpse, just a glimpse behind those labels, into that less defined, more mysterious dimension, the metaphor response that naturally arises is all the stronger, because we don't need that other person to be a certain way to receive it. We don't want them or us to be any different. We're not dependent on any illusions about them. So to engage with each other effectively as the Sangha jewel, we need an approach where that mystery of the person, yeah, is really celebrated. It's allowed to unfold. You really need to sort of celebrate that not knowingness. So we can. It's about understanding the flow of conditions and loving that flow of conditions just as they are. At the same time, we support the causes for future happiness and the corresponding reduction in suffering that arises through our ethical practice. Yeah, while at the same time learning to love it all for its own intrinsic mystery, and not dependent on whether someone is acting in a particular way in relation to us. So I'm really talking about an openness, an awareness, a way of looking that allows a gentle questioning of the assumptions on which we base our actions. Although, of course, it may feel like we're at the centre of our universe, increasingly we can see how limited we are by this view. Yeah? For a long time, we may be acting from that place, but we don't have to believe in it. Yeah? We don't have to entrench that view. Yeah? And coming into relationship with others with that same motivation, yeah, that same passion to go beyond those assumptions and limitations, when we engage as a Sangha, that can really sort of help us not to entrench that view. It can help us to get a glimpse of how different things could be. So practicing in these collective contexts where our heart can open and with this desire to go beneath these assumptions, go beneath the assumptions, no holds barred, yeah? Wherever they're restricting assumptions, we just go beneath them, yeah? So in these conditions, our awareness of others will just naturally start to transform into something much more like awareness with others. Yeah, just greatest awareness with others. Yeah, we'll be moving even more firmly, even more deeply. Yeah, from I to we. Now, in practice, I don't think what we're doing, it doesn't need to look, it won't look very different to how we generally operate anyway in our centres, in our communities, in our shared projects. I've had the privilege to witness a number of very sincere groups of practitioners in the wider Buddhist context, the wider Buddhist world, and they've often commented on how well we do Sangha, yeah? And I think we do Sangha, in inverted commas, very, very well. The more we treasure and value that jewel of Sangha and imbue it with that quality of conscious, loving awareness that takes us into this mysterious territory, the more we celebrate the mysteriousness of that territory, the more that Sangha jewel will shine. The more this happens, the more, I'm sorry about this, but the more mysterious it does get, the harder it gets to talk about. As Banti says, it's extremely difficult to explain the nature of consciousness or awareness that characterizes the spiritual community at its best. Yeah? He says, it's not the sum total of the individual consciousnesses concerned. It's not the sum total of the individual consciousness is concerned, nor even a kind of collective consciousness, not even a collective consciousness, yeah, but a consciousness of an entirely different order. Yeah? It's what he's called the third order of consciousness. He says that because of this, when we engage consciously in Sangha in this way, there's the potential to experience this freedom, this complete freedom of consciousness, this unimpeded loving awareness. So coming together in that depth and commitment of awareness, it's as if, he says, all the awareness is present, all the awareness present is strengthened and enhanced. Lack of self-reference is paramount, yeah? And the collective active aspect of the experience really reinforces that it's not about us and our separate experience. So if we keep practicing together like this, we can arrive at an experience which is sometimes called bodhicitta. Heart mind of awakening, a pouring forth of unconditional love, which is entirely unreferenced by me or other. So, while it's an extremely alive experience, it's not a personal possession. Yeah? Drawing from Indian mythology, it's like this vast nest of precious jewels shining incandescently. Yeah? It's shining with this completely free-flowing, unimpeded loving awareness. And each jewel glows in the light of every other jewel. Yeah? And every other jewel shines on every other jewel. Yeah? So that's it, really. That's the image that we're left with. I do hope that I've said enough to highlight the importance, the joy, as well as some of the difficulties of taking other people as practice of awareness. Yeah? Of learning to empathise more with others on their own terms, not on ours. Yeah, moving gradually, sensitively from I to we. Yeah, and also perhaps to point to the potentially unlimited freedom which becomes possible when we take our awareness deeper. Yeah? Taking a look beneath the veil of our labels and our deep assumptions to a love that's not limited by any illusions. Yeah? I hope we can see that how this can be made more possible by engaging consciously and effectively with each other and illuminating each other as Sangha.